This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
I find myself marvelling at how many elements of daily life there could, in some way, be described as Baroque. Our sunsets, our cuisine, our pollution, our corruption. Century after century, the country has exhibited a great tendency towards exuberance and a natural bent for the strange and the marvelous. There's a constant play between veiling and unveiling. Even in our newscasts, one senses indirect meaning in everything, as well as a fluidity of form in which excess triumphs every time over restraint. 300 years of colonial rule produced an intense syncretism of indigenous and European cultures, a bold new aesthetic accompanied by many new paradoxes, and these can be glimpsed today in both lighter and darker manifestations, some playful and others barbaric. Mexican Baroque emerged from the conquest of the New World, from the long fraught process of negotiation and subjugation that began to unfold once the Spaniards established their rule in 1521. The European monarchs wanted as much gold as their conquistadors could plunder, while their missionaries sought to convert the pagan savages to Catholicism. The Aztecs, of course, had their own gods, a monumental pantheon that included the fierce and formidable Quetzalcoatl and Huitzilopochtli, yet these ancient powers proved no match for colonial rapacity. There was one pivotal overlap between the two religions, however, a fortuitous convergence which helped ease the transition from the Aztec cosmology to the Catholic faith. And this was the theater of death present in both religions. Accustomed to their own culture of human sacrifice, the Indians identified with the crucifixion and other violent chapters in the new theology, and were thus gradually lured in by its passions and taste for the macabre. In artistic portrayals of certain scenes from the New Testament, the blood and drama were laid on thick. The Churrigueresque style brought over from Spain, a highly florid and heavily laden version of Rococo, found its most triumphant expression, one could argue, in Mexico. The church architects were Spanish, yet the artisans and laborers were indigenous and mestizo, and these asserted their autonomy from the metropolis by adding local materials such as tetzontle, a red porous volcanic stone, and local motifs, with quetzals and hummingbirds and faces with native features finding their way into the chiseled landscapes. In all their magnificence, the gilt altars and church facades also betrayed a horror of silence and empty space, every inch of wood, stucco, and stone teeming with detail, as if replicating the delirious splendor of the natural world beyond. The monolithic sculptures of the Aztecs and earlier pre-Hispanic civilizations, signs of a certain stability, were replaced by more fluid and volatile art, one which favored movement over form, agility over monumentality. Like most art of the Baroque, it too thrived off a play of contrasts and opposites, and this was most poignantly articulated in the historical counterpoint between the Aztec emperor Moctezuma and the Spanish conquistador Hernán Cortés, the dialectic between victor and vanquished spilling over into one between old gods and new, the awe of the conquistadors upon discovering this marvel of a land versus the increasing disenchantment of its natives, their gods toppled, their beliefs exploited. To a large extent, the soul of modern Mexico was born from this collision. One arena in present-day Mexico in which a conflict of archetypes can literally be seen is in the spectacle of lucha libre, or freestyle wrestling, another European import to which was added local color and verve. Different theories exist regarding its origins. Some say an early variant was brought over in 1863 during the French intervention, or in 1910 by a Spanish boxing promoter. A more accepted notion is that the sport came to Mexico in the early 1920s, courtesy of two dueling Italian theater troupes. Everything about the performance favors emotion over form. The movements are exaggerated, as are the wrestlers themselves, massive hulks of men in tights who wear capes like those of superheroes and shiny carnivalesque masks that hide their faces. There's a certain splendor to them, but once the match begins, the splendor is undercut by an atmosphere of buffoonery. At rest, the wrestlers appear regal and imposing. In motion, the elegance is quickly undermined by their comical leaps and bounds. It is as if they start off by embodying the first period of Baroque in Mexico, in the late 17th century, characterized by solemn church facades, rich and refined. And then they go on to embody its second period from the mid-18th century, which was more opulent and chaotic, an architecture of Solomonic columns that twist, spiral, and writhe. The wrestlers' masks often evoke their powers and persona. El Santo, Blue Demon, Fray Tormenta, Huracán Ramírez, Rey Misterio. They are costumed heroes and villains, engaged in a jocular battle between good and evil. The Baroque fondness for extremes is felt in every match, which is fought between a técnico, one who follows the rules and plays cleanly and gracefully, and a rudo, one who transgresses, breaking codes with relish. In this play of adversaries, there is no guarantee that good will win. In fact, the rudos are often expected to triumph, hinting at a cultural acceptance that righteousness, in Mexico at least, isn't necessarily rewarded. In a sense, the showdown between Moctezuma and Cortés could similarly be envisioned as a battle between a técnico and a rudo. The Aztec emperor, honest and honorable and deferential to his guests, played by the rules, while the conquistador lied and cheated and, thanks in part to his deviousness, succeeded in bringing down an entire civilization. The wild gestures that fuel the lucha libre spectacle elicit a frantic emotional intensity. Audiences work themselves into a lather, subjecting the wrestlers to a loud repertoire of insults, mostly bawdy and vulgar, as if they were taking sides in some kind of moral contest rather than a sporting tournament. In Baroque art, movement tends to be centrifugal, a restlessness away from the center, as opposed to the classical impulse of restraint. Although the wrestlers lunge at one another, they are constantly being cast outwards, either by their opponent's thrust or the elastic ring, their main instrument for propulsion. Performers often take flying leaps outside the ring and land in the audience. Similar to what Caravaggio did in his paintings, these suicides, as the moves are called, break down the boundary and remove the safety barrier between viewer and spectacle. One can smell the sweat, feel the flesh, hear the grunts, almost grasp the energy of the wrestler as he comes crashing into us. Something deeply Dionysian haunts the spectacle, chaotic and unpolished. And yet it is often marked by pathos, sometimes the mere sight of a massive lump of a man unable to haul himself up, or, even more so, when a wrestler is defeated and his mask removed. The moment his identity is revealed, his strength and aura dissolve. A more recent and dismaying phenomenon of Baroque excess and hyperbole, where the human body again becomes a site of transformation, yet the spectacle of bloodshed is real, not staged, is within the violence wrought by the warring drug cartels. Since 2006, Mexico has been in the grip of a disastrous war on drugs, initiated by our then-president Felipe Calderón when he took office. Over 60,000 individuals have lost their lives as the cartels battle amongst themselves for territory, while a weakened military and often corrupt police force try desperately to control them. Nearly every day the news offers reports of beheadings and dismemberment, of a violence and brutality so extreme that even the depiction of severed body parts in Goya's Disasters of War seems restrained. The deep-rooted anxiety about fragmentation in Goya, and also Bosch's work, is surpassed by the chilling real-life images of human mutilation we have in Mexico. It goes without saying that narco violence is not an art, yet the graphic mise-en-scene could similarly be read as allegories of great socio-political disintegration, and the headless bodies as metaphors for a country without any real leadership. Mexicans are accustomed to severed body parts. They have been an element of our landscape since pre-Hispanic times. Skulls in particular feature in every one of our civilizations, the hollow eye sockets and bared teeth, a presence from ancient eras through to modern. Yet these skulls have become so detached from their cadavers, they seem to exist entirely on their own, devoid of humanity. And it is one thing to see images in stone at the Museum of Anthropology, and quite another to witness heads with their hair and flesh still on them, faces one could have glimpsed on the metro yesterday. The ancient skulls formed part of a metaphysics, whereas the decapitated heads of today signal chaos and collapse. In Uruapan, a city in my father's northwestern state of Michoacán, masked men stormed into a discotheque called Sol y Sombra, Sun and Shadow, and tossed five severed heads onto the dance floor. This incident, which took place over 6 years ago, was one of the first outings of La Familia, a drug cartel composed of right-wing vigilantes who quickly established their bloody reign over the region. The photographic image of these decapitated heads, each with its trail of blood where it has rolled out from the black plastic bag, is hard to erase from memory. Their eyes are closed, their faces a shiny olive color. The gangrene of death has yet to set in. In their midst, a large scroll emblazoned with a warning for rival cartels, a handwritten message that ends with the words, "Divine Justice." Other cartels, like the Zetas, the Gulf Cartel, and the Sinaloa Cartel, are similarly fond of leaving behind gruesome memento mori. Bodies, often headless, are dangled from bridges or left in segments by the side of the road. Here Barak is taken to an extreme, deformed into excess and true monstrosity. The tremendous striving for effect, a desire to make the most startling impact on the senses, has mutated into an unabashed theatricality of the utmost violence. There are, these days, few signs of redemption. In a regrettable twist of the Barak, its original vitality has been contorted, redirected towards death rather than life. One finds similar aesthetic criteria, a similar dynamism and instinct for theatricality, yet the early religious impulses have morphed into their opposite. And for some, the only religion left, it seems, is death itself. Perhaps the most literal manifestation of contemporary Barak, a true syncretism of Spanish Catholicism and pre-Hispanic beliefs, is to be found in the cult of La Santa Muerte, or Holy Death, the patron saint of the Mexican underworld, who is a sanctified personification of death herself. Though her cult incorporates dozens of Catholic rituals, she remains vehemently unrecognized by the Church. The millions who worship La Santa Muerte tend to belong to the more marginal or endangered strata of society. Criminals, transvestites, drug dealers, prostitutes, taxi drivers, police officers. They are individuals who live by violence or are threatened by it. Those who exist in a perpetual twilight and, professionally, mostly by night. And they come to her for protection. I first encounter La Santa Muerte at her main altar in Tepito, Mexico City's shadowy sanctum of drugs and contraband. There she stood, behind a glass pane, a tall skeleton in a long black wig, a jeweled crown, a sparkling gold dress, and a diaphanous cape. She was heavily adorned, an embodiment of Barak's dual pull towards death and sensuality, and I couldn't help feeling like I was seeing a pre-Hispanic skull in Spanish robes. In one hand she held a globe of the world, in the other the scales of justice. Spread out at her feet was a semicircle of figurines, smaller versions of herself, and a flickering landscape of ephemeral offerings. Candles, apples, flowers, incense, beer, bottles of tequila, lit cigarettes. I watched as the devotees queued up to press their hands against the pane and murmur their prayers, then quietly deposit a gift. When the Spaniards arrived in Mexico, Moctezuma, believing they were gods, had his emissaries bring Cortes tortillas smeared with human blood as an offering. The emperor himself was a sybaritic gourmet, presented with around 300 dishes a day made from ingredients brought in from all over the country. Human sacrifice also formed part of the cuisine, and his priests would cook up the remains of sacrificial victims in squash flour soup. The most Barak dish to emerge from the conquest is mole poblano, a thick sauce like dark blood concocted from chocolate, almonds, spices, and three types of chili, originally put together by nuns in a convent in Puebla. In Mexico, there's a saying that the spicier a food, and the more it makes you cry, the tastier it is. True culinary enjoyment should be accompanied by a bit of agony. To this day, mole remains our most popular dish, served at all ceremonial events, a fiery reminder of the lavish, tempestuous, rioting energies from which modern Mexico was born.
The essay was presented